another BigGoldSeek.com radio episode and our featured guest. He's the editor and chief investment strategist of Charts and Markets. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Hello there, and it's good to be with you, Chris.
Well, it's just a pleasure to have you back with us today. And the topic du jour, ladies and gentlemen, on this holiday special episode, of course, they're calling it the Mnuchin Massacre. Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, issued an emphatic, and I'm quoting here, statement saying that our POTUS had denied he was going to fire our Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, whom he actually helped gain the federal chair.
As you point out, there's focuses on the Federal Reserve. This really requires some perspective.
Last week, the Dow Jones Industrials shed over 1,600 points for the week. And then on Monday, following the very unusual weekend where the Treasury Secretary was actually issuing this announcement on Christmas Eve, this is unprecedented. So the markets don't like uncertainty, Bob Hoy. And then Monday, on I guess what would have been a half-day holiday on the New York Stock Exchange, we shed another 650 points.
One of the worst Decembers, maybe ever, but I'd have to look at that.
The worst monthly chart on a percentage basis I can find going back to the 1800s.
Yeah, so it's a bad market. The Fed made a mistake. Mnuchin said it made a mistake because he was panicking more than the market was to make it the suggestions he did. Now, you got to, Chris, put the Federal Reserve System in perspective. Originally, it was bankers, so there was some sort of responsibility there. Then also, then later on, in the 60s, the makeup of the Fed and the changed to economists. And then the Fed became everything to everybody. It would make sure that the recovery would be kept going. And then in the absolutely bizarre idea that a stock market would go down, it would prevent bad things from happening. And it is a fraud, a farce. And so what you have here is a perfectly natural bear market for stocks. And the selling is often proportionate to the degree of speculation on the up. And I saw a line I used the other day, Chris, which was, it was like a very excited cat that ran 40 feet up a 20-foot tall tree. So this is what you've got here. You had speculators up a 40-foot tall tree, or up 40 feet up a 20-foot tall tree, and, of course, it's got to go down. So here's how they work. This was the sixth great financial bubble in history, but the first one being the South Sea Bubble of 1720. When you do the history on these things, Chris, you'll realize that there are strong similarities on the way up a bubble, like in the last year or so of it. There's strong similarities as they peak, and then there's strong similarities on the, let's call it a collapse. So here's the big picture, and this was decades ago when I discovered this, but the South Sea Bubble peaked in 1720, and the equivalent great boom in commodities had peaked 9 years earlier in 1711. So then you move ahead, and there was a good bubble in 1873, and commodities and the rate of inflation in the U.S. had peaked in 1864 with the Civil War, 9 years. Then you had the Great War of 1914 to 1918, where global commodities soared to an exceptional high in 1920, and then they crashed. And here's where things get interesting, because the then new Federal Reserve System looked at the horrendous deflation of 1921 and it colored all economists' view. So they were very fearful of falling prices. So through the mid-1920s, the Federal Reserve was easy with its monetary policy because they didn't want commodities to go down. But they didn't understand that once you've had the commodity boom, then you'll get a boom in financial assets, which was then you brewed up with the infamous peak in 1929 and crash, and that was the 9 years. So we've had some booms over the last 20 plus years with the dot-com bubble in 2000, and you had a crash. You had a very good bull market complete in 2007, and they say that it was the most severe contraction since the 1930s. But on those two bubbles, what was missing was that there had not been a preceding big peak in commodities 9 years earlier. So then we move along to 2008, when crude oil soared to 147, and you had that bubble stock side peaked in 2007, and the housing side of that one peaked in 2006. So that one we did a good job on. But anyways, you ended up with a bear market. But within that, of course, was that you had the commodities, including crude oil, at the highest ever, and the big bubble, and the biggest commodity boom since 1920. So then you recall that through the last decade, the Federal Reserve was very fearful about falling wholesale prices, or as they now call them, producer prices, and has been easy trying to get the rate of inflation to hold at 2%. Now, I did mention that in the 1920s, the Fed was worried about weak prices and was exceptionally easy, not understanding that the nature of financial speculation. So anyways, here we got the same pattern. And then you had the stock market. If you use the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index, that peaked in January of this year. You also look at the CWI, which is a world stock index without the U.S. market in it, and that also peaked in January. So you look at the timing, because we know when the commodities peaked in 1920 by the month. So that bull market from 1920 to September 1929 was nine years and 5 months. And then this time, from the commodity peak in 2008 to the stock peak in 2018, was 9 years and 7 months. So kind of fascinating. And you then now, you can now say that the stock market is in a bear market, and you have the things that go with that, Chris. You have, from May, June, weakening commodity prices. You recall that we were looking last February for commodities to firm up, industrial commodities to firm up into May, June. They did. We called those our friends of the bull market. Then with that, we also expected the credit markets to be friendly, and they were also our friends of the bull market. But the line we used was that generally sunshine through to mid-year, August would turn to twilight, and then after August would be the twilight zone. You recall that very scary TV series from ages ago. So, and we now are in the twilight zone. There's nothing any central bank or Treasury Department can do about it.
an excellent historical overview, and it brings, I think, the markets into perspective today, though I can't help but note, though, we are entering what appears to be a financial twilight zone. I like your, you know, memories of Rod Serling and all of the, you know, sci-fi. Today we have Ray Bradbury, we have Philip K. Dick, Electric Dreams, which is now really popular. The idea you bring up about the central banks, then they're powerless. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange's Fed Funds Futures. This is the go-to spot if you want to know what the big money, the smart money, if you will, or at least the deep pockets, what they think the Fed is going to do. You can now see the Fed Fund Futures into early January of 2020. Now, I've reviewed it, gave folks last Friday, okay, just a few days ago, the day before the beginning of Hanukkah, okay, 3 days before Christmas Eve, gave our listeners a view into the future because I said, folks, according to the Fed Funds Futures, the Fed has finished their rate hiking cycle. This December, that was it. Your thoughts seem to corroborate that. Very low current probabilities for any of the 2 to 3 rate hikes the Fed had been telegraphing for all of 2019. These markets turn around and the economy continues to remain very robust. They're going to still need to put the brakes on. Of course, we know they cannot any more than you can remove a Supreme Court justice. Once they're in place, they're essentially in place.
Oh, yeah. Now, first, you've got to understand that at the exciting times in the credit markets, which are at the bottom of a bear market for stocks and at the top of a bubble. Now, history shows that in the senior central bank, it was the Bank of England before the Federal Reserve, that market rates of interest change, like short-dated, the equivalent of treasury bills are the equivalent, change before the Fed or the senior central bank changes the administered rate. So please understand, and our listeners, that the senior central bank follows changes in market rates of interest. They do not set interest rates. So here we are now. What drives short rates up in a boom is, of course, the demand for speculative money to fund leveraged positions. And that leveraged positions, of course, is outside of the stock market as well. It's in the yield curve and credit spreads. It's also in real estate and everywhere. So what I'm watching for now is the treasury bill rate to turn down, and then probably some months later, then the Fed will find the reason to lower rates. So the next change in interest rates will be short rates falling. You've already got the long rates for junk bonds going up. Now, that's critical in the collapse of speculation. The low-grade bonds go no bid eventually. So the key to things now is the treasury bill rate turning down, and we will be watching it because, as I've often written about credit markets, when they get on a trend, they go forever. And then, Chris, I usually add, and then some. So the key now is to watch for the treasury bill rate, and it will, I think, soon turn down. And then after that, the Fed will go through some convolutions while they come up with a reason why they then are lowering rates. But as recently as 2007, in September, when there were strains developing in the credit markets, Wall Street pundits there then got out and said not to worry because the Fed would cut rates. Now, we haven't seen that. But keep in mind that throughout business history, of which there's pretty good details for more than 300 years, that short rates go up in a boom and down in a bust. So here you have the top Wall Street pundits in 2007 saying not to worry because the Fed was soon going to lower rates. But if you take a look at financial history, you'll realize that the fastest declines in short interest rates occur with the worst bear markets. So and to flip it, go other way, there's considerable irony, is that rising T-bill rates, with the Fed following with rising Fed fund rates, indicates the boom is on. So here you've had the professional Wall Street punsters spending the summer worrying about rising interest rates. Of course, I spent the summer writing saying rising interest rates confirms the boom is on. So now we're looking for the short rates to go down. We've already got the yield curve began to change last summer at the far outs, like the 5 to 30 year reversed. And we also wrote in the summer that you didn't need to have the curve invert. All you needed to do is have it reversed, and it had reversed by late September, and then the rest followed. So you've got each of those great bubbles, Chris, since 1720, and this is number six, ran into liquidity problems in the fall and suffered forced liquidation, which we have. And most, now here's the pattern on them, which was fascinating, and I put it together decades ago, is that you'd have heavy liquidation in October, down to late October, which we got, a rebound, which we got, and then a test of the lows in November. But one of those bubbles, the one of 1825, which was a huge one, it was magnificent. That one, the liquidity problems didn't clear until December 24th of that year. And where are we here now? My guess is that the immediate liquidity problems have probably maximized. We've got a couple of our indicators showing downside capitulations, and we're looking for a few other things to conclude that probably the worst is in. And it's the worst is in, Chris, fitting with a historical past.
I mean, obviously, we've seen T-bills, T-notes, their yields absolutely collapsing in recent weeks. This is an interesting trend because we hadn't seen that for a while. On Monday alone, of course, Christmas Eve, I believe it was, I think just a half session, you know, we saw gold explode almost an entire week's worth of gains, about $14 added to last week's gains. You know, we're over $100 off of the lows here. We've sliced through every resistance level. Do you agree with a lot of our guests that if we can clear the 1450 area, it might be back on for a bull market?
Yeah, you've got to put my historical hat on again. There were long periods in economic history when the senior central bank had a convertible currency, convertible into gold. You know, that was sterling in England for more than 100 years, and you still had great financial booms and busts. So and you take the real price of gold, like you deflate it by the rate of inflation in the consumer and the CPI, and it tells you a story. And what it says is that when you're in a great financial mania, gold's real price goes down. Like the real price recently was at its best in 2011, and then that's really when the financial mania started to fly. And it's coming all the way down, and it can say for the last year and a half, it's trying to base. So then when you take gold's real price in 1929 or 1873 or 1825, any of those great bubbles, the price went down during the boom, and gold stocks were underperformers, where almost every other stock they could promote to the moon. Here comes the problem, is that in a liquidity crisis and going into a financial contraction, the careful money goes to the most liquid items, which are treasury bills in the U.S. dollar, and also gold is liquid. So it's going to be buying gold, and the careful money is going to be buying U.S. treasury bills. So you're going to have a firm to steady U.S. dollar. You're going to get some rallies in gold, but I wouldn't play gold itself long in U.S. dollars because the money will be made is where it's been made in previous Great Depressions, is in gold stocks. Gold divided by the CPI, our view is that it's built a base over the last year and a half, and it's close to breaking out. And when you have gold's real price going down, it means that the gold miners are having problems getting enough price for their product against how much it's costing them to mine it. You got high costs of fuel, high cost of mining equipment, high cost of wages. And then when you go into the post-bubble contraction, all of that changes. And gold mining is the one thing that you can analyze that is going to become very profitable. So I don't care about what gold does in U.S. dollar terms. I care about what gold does relative to the cost of mining, and this should go up. So I've mainly mentioned the producers, whereby their costs become weak relative to what they're getting for bullion. But it also affects exploration properties, whereby demand for... Here's the other thing I mentioned, is Chris, is that when people get scared and buy gold, the investment demand for gold increases. So you're going to have increasing investment demand for gold. That will then make profitability flow back into the gold miners. And then also it enhances the valuation of any exploration projects that one has or one's looking at as an investor. And having been being a very old geophysicist and having spent some time in mining exploration, I really like the exploration side when you get into the bull market, and which we are probably starting with, as I said, the real price. So our advice in the last couple of months has been to accumulate gold stocks on weakness. And at first it was a minor position, and then 2 weeks ago we said, you know, to add to positions on buying on weakness. So the best bull markets have happened in post-bubble contractions. And even, Chris, the greatest gold rushes in history have occurred at the depression bottoms, like the 1930s. Depression, many men unemployed, and the real price of gold goes up, so people go looking for it, and when they find it, you have a discovery rush. That was the same depression bottom in 1895. You had the Klondike, and then 1840s, that was a depression bottom, and you had the gold discovery in California. Also in Melbourne, Australia, was a gold rush. So each of the depression bottoms have been fantastic for gold. And so I'm looking forward to that again. I think that we are at the start of a very lengthy bull market for the gold sector. Of course, there will be some business recessions and booms. You know, you're going to, well, I don't want to use the term boom, but the economy will continue to fluctuate with weak recoveries, but relentless contractions. But there's also something else that's going to happen in here, Crispy, other than the discovery that the gold mining sector is the place to be. People are going to have a critical view on central bank and policymakers who spent trillions of dollars of taxpayers' money trying to prevent bad things from happening. And the bad thing has started. So the public's going to say, what are you idiots doing? And what they also have been doing is they've set up a financial system so that the big traders and big banks can't lose money. They make it a speculative environment where they can make huge money on the way up, and then when it turns bad, they bail them out. Now, this is going to set up, let's call it a common sense revolution. And the public is not going to like it. So you've had, we've talked about now since 2016, a popular uprising going on where people take a look at in your face and in your wallet governments and say no, and through political fortune, the popular uprising ended up with Trump as its executive, and while he's in a storm, you know, a political storm, the movement with Trump leading is attempting to do the right thing, which is to constrain government ambition. So there's two aspects to this. One is actually the people taking over the government again. Remember the saying, we the people? And they also, the people will insist on having sound money. Because what has happened with the Federal Reserve System is no matter how altruistic they originally thought it was, it has become a tool of big government. So the Fed was corrupted from what it might have been to providing unlimited funds to an experiment in unlimited government. So this is where the wall has been built. We often talk about the Berlin Wall and preventing people from leaving the workers' paradise. But with the Obama administration, that government was then building the legislative or regulatory equivalent of the Berlin Wall under Obama. And this is now what's happening with the popular uprising, is they're attempting to take the regulatory equivalent of the Berlin Wall down brick by brick. And I think that a financial contraction will motivate the people to look at the government as the problem, as Reagan frequently stated. And instead of pleading for more government, they're going to say enough. And it's happening in other countries. You've got the Yellow Vest uprising.
Right, in Paris, right?
We've got a long-time subscriber that runs money in Holland. And he sent a couple of notes maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago pointing out that the police there are facing their equivalent, Holland's equivalent of the Yellow Vest, and saying, look it, guys, we're with you. Just don't do any property damage, and we're going to all be happy. It'll work out. Make your point. Now, here's where my history really comes in, Chris, because in 1975, I came across some papers by a researcher by the name of Barbara Bell, and she was working on climate cycles in the Nile River, where you would have long periods of favorable floods, then a climate change and unfavorable floods. So the gist of the story is that with favorable floods, every year you had good crops and more crops, so then you'd have more people. And then when you went unfavorable, every year you have less, so then there's strains in the system. But of course, the governing classes controlled the grain, and they were living well and promising well. The irony in those situations was that the palace guards protecting the governing classes were not of the governing classes, they were of the people. And when push came to shove, suddenly one day the palace guards laid down their spears. Yeah, they called it interregnum, they called it dynasty change. But anyways, the government got back in the hands of the people and food distribution as well. So then I knew about that when we were going into the late 1980s, when there were popular uprisings in Eastern Europe. And so the thing to watch for was on the border guards in East Germany and other part of East Berlin. And the border guards were not of the governing classes. They were of the people. And then one day they just laid down their AK-47s. And all the Germans wanted to do was go cross-border shopping. And they went cross-border shopping. And then the dictator in East Germany, Honecker, he had to immediately change the law that required him to murder Germans for going from one part of Germany to another part. So sure, there was Gorbachev and there was Reagan and all that sort of stuff, but essentially it was the same old pattern whereby the folks get fed up with too much government and they rise, because it takes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of the fist pounding down on the people, the authoritarian fist. We cover interest rates, equities, commodities, currencies, precious metals, and you can get in touch real easy, just bobhoy.com. And we welcome people to take a look at what we're doing. But just Google Bob Hoy and you'll get it. As you know, Chris, and you can get in touch with us, Bob Hoy, just do bobhoy.com, bobhoy.com.
Bob Hoy, Institutional Advisor. We'll talk soon.
Good to talk. Bye-bye.